Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's speaker is Mark Morial, President and CEO of the National Urban League, and recognized as one of the top nonprofit executives in the country.
Mark Morial has a very long and distinguished career in a variety of occupations. He's been an entrepreneur, a legislator, an attorney, a professor, a mayor, and currently, as you know, he's president and CEO of the National Urban League. He created several small businesses, starting out creating a janitorial company when he was 15. At 26, he was one of the youngest, or was the youngest, lawyer to argue and win a major case before the Louisiana Supreme Court. He's been an adjunct faculty member in law at Xavier University in Louisiana, where he's also taught constitutional law and business law. When he was elected to the Louisiana State Senate, he was named Legislative Rookie of the Year, Education Senator of the Year, and Environmental Senator of the Year. As mayor of New Orleans, his father was also, by the way, mayor of New Orleans, Mayor Morial became known for his tough stance on crime and corruption, as well as, and was so successful that he left office with a 70% approval rating. He was elected mayor in 1994. He campaigned on that promise to reduce crime and clean out City Hall and end corruption in the police department. During the time he was mayor, violent crime declined by 60%, which led to a rebirth, of course, of interest in investments in and interest in historic neighborhoods. Poverty rate fell, unemployment was cut in half. After terms as mayor, Morial became president of the National Urban League in 2003, where he leads the charge to explain the league's work in providing economic empowerment and educational opportunities and guarantee for civil rights for African Americans and all of individuals in cities. He's had great success in fundraising at the Urban League. The Empowerment Fund has pumped in nearly $200 million into urban impact business, including minority business through debt and equity investments. Mark Morial is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, a small university in a fine city, but it is an urban university. He also attended Georgetown University Law School, which in Indianapolis, I've learned, is an approved law school with some of our when your governor is a graduate, and Ann Nobles, I see out here, is also a graduate, almost as fine a law school as one right on our campus. I'm not supposed to editorialize. I'm sorry. Morial serves on the executive committee of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, the Black Leadership Forum, and the Leadership 18, as well as is a board member of the Muhammad Ali Center and the New Jersey Performing Arts Center. He served as the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors and has been recognized as one of the 100 most influential black Americans by Ebony Magazine and one of the top 50 nonprofit executives by the Nonprofit Times. Let's all welcome him for his remarks.
Thank you very much. First of all, good afternoon. Let me express my thanks to all of you, especially to the leadership of the Economic Club, for giving me an opportunity today to begin what is a three-day tour for us, our Indiana Jobs Tour, visiting communities beginning here in Indianapolis, then to Anderson, Fort Wayne, and Gary, Indiana. So it's great to be here this year in 2011. Let me confess that, and Joe Slash, you don't even know this, that I was on my way to Indianapolis about a year ago. It was in February of 2010. This is 2011, of course. And I got to the airport, and I had on black pants. I had on a black and gold tie. And I had on a gold hat with a fleur-de-lis on it. I was dressed in my Saints uniform. But something told me that 2 weeks after the Super Bowl victory over your beloved Indianapolis Colts was just not a time that I would be welcomed in Indianapolis. So I decided to buy 12 months, and I'm here this year. So this year, we can both be mad at the Packers and the Steelers. And I don't have to be mad at you, and you don't have to be mad at me. But I certainly celebrate this wonderful city. We lent you from New Orleans, Peyton Manning. We lent you Marshall Faulk. And for a while, we even lent you Jim Mora. Remember him? But let me just again express my thanks to all of you. This is indeed a special opportunity to speak to all of you today. And I do want to just acknowledge some friends and colleagues. Joe, where are you? Where's Joe? Joe, way in the back. Stand up, Joe. Joe, the president of the Urban League here in Indianapolis, only the second president that we've had. He's followed the legendary Sam Jones and continues to do incredible work for us. And I'll have more to say about that later. I also want to acknowledge Ann Nobles, the Chief Compliance and Ethics Officer at Eli Lilly. She is a member of the National Urban League Board of Trustees, so she's one of my bosses and a great, great partner at Eli Lilly. Thank you very much, Ann. Let's give Ann a big round of applause. And I count among friends and to some extent role models two of your former mayors with whom I've had friendships and relationships and collaborations, Steve Goldsmith, who was mayor of this city some time ago, who's now working for Mayor Bloomberg in New York City, and Bart Peterson, who was also mayor. I count them amongst friends, and Indianapolis has had a great tradition back to Mayors Hudnut and Luger, all the way through history, of having great leaders of this community, and I certainly do want to acknowledge that. Here in Indiana, as we begin this jobs tour, Indiana and Indianapolis are not unlike many great American cities and many states. Challenged and struggling, but also with a degree of optimism and hope and thinking and planning about its future. These are no doubt difficult times for the nation. I think 45 of the 50 states are grappling with budgetary and fiscal challenges, challenges not only with their pension funds, but just challenges with making ends meet to retain services at the level that they are at, not to mention the challenges that municipal governments face all across the nation with the fiscal challenges, but also the social and economic challenges that communities will face when you have high unemployment. 16% is really the true unemployment rate in this nation when you count the people who've discontinued looking and those who may be in part-time work but desirous of in need or in need of full-time work. So we face that. In America's urban communities today, the majority of the top or largest 35 cities in America are all facing unemployment rates of 15% or higher. This is a time of incredible challenge. What we have faced as a nation over the last 24 plus to 36 months is indeed the challenge of our times and the challenge of our generation. Because since World War II, or should I say since the Great Depression, the nation has experienced seven economic recessions. And of those, the one we have experienced and we continue to experience today is the worst. It was by far longer. It was by far deeper. The unemployment rate and the growth rate went down at a greater degree than all of the recessions that have taken place since the Great Depression. Some economists even believe that if we measured unemployment today the way we measured unemployment in the 30s, we would not be using the R, we might have used the D word, the depression word, for what we've faced as a nation. But I want all of us to think that this recession is also part of a series of events that have affected this nation in the last decade. Great events, and they have challenged so many things. The 9/11 tragedy and the terrorist attack on the United States, a war in Iraq and a war in Afghanistan, the failures of the government with Hurricane Katrina, the subprime crisis and the Great Recession, the Gulf oil spill. And when you take all of these events together, all taking place in a concentrated 10-year period, ladies and gentlemen, we've been through something. We've been through a series of difficulty. A series of events, each one standing alone, is going to be the subject of multiple books, analysis by historians and journalists for decades, indeed, I would submit to you, centuries to come because of the nature of those events. Here in Indiana, obviously, your economic situation is challenged like so many, but maybe in better shape than your cohorts here in the Midwest, Ohio, and indeed Michigan. Maybe a little bit better. But what I have been impressed with in my visits to Indianapolis, and certainly with some of the discussions that I had this morning, is that there does seem to be a strong sense in this community, a strong sense about some of the things that Indianapolis and Indiana need to do to try to rebuild the economy of this region. And it is no different than the challenges that other communities and other cities face. So I want to talk a little bit today about them. First, the National Urban League has promulgated a 12-point job plan. These 12 points, you may look at it and you may say, I agree with all of them. You may look at it and say, I don't agree with any of them. You probably look at it and say, there are things in here I absolutely agree with. The point is that we wanted to put forth a plan. We wanted to put forth coherent thinking about what we should do coming out of this recession, coming out of these jobs losses to rebuild the economy of this nation, because we think the number one issue for the nation's business and political leaders is jobs. The number two issue for the nation's business and political leaders is jobs. And the number three issue for the nation's business and civic leaders is jobs. And all discussions about public policy should indeed focus on jobs. I want to point out in this plan a few ideas that I think are worthy of a little bit of examination. The first is, it's idea number 6 in the book, and it talks about creating green empowerment zones. One of the exciting things that people are talking about in this economy and in this nation is how we build an economy that is green. How do we build green buildings? How do we build a new set of jobs that focus on green industries? But what we are about to do and what has begun to happen is we have begun to lose so much of the solar panel manufacturing and assembly business to nations across the sea. So here we are talking about alternative energy as a path to economic independence, And we're allowing it to become a new chapter in economic dependence, where we'll depend on items made someplace else to power our green economy. It is a single example of why we think that the future of urban communities can be green jobs if we align our incentives. So we at the National Urban League have proposed to the Congress, Democrats, Republicans, independents, non-aligned, aligned, anybody who listened, the idea of creating deep and sustainable incentives simply so that solar panel and perhaps wind turbine assembly facilities would be located in urban communities. Look at some of these old industrial plants here in central Indiana and ask yourselves if they could easily be retrofitted if we aligned the incentives correctly. We have to get serious. We can't just mouth our way into a green economy. We've got to create incentives to nurture the business development and nurture the jobs right here in our urban communities. Secondly, you know that there is a vigorous debate taking place. It's taking place in this state, in Wisconsin, as well as in the nation's capital, about how the nation should get its fiscal house in order. There's no question that the nation has taken on a great deal of debt. But here is what's important to understand. The debt that the nation has taken on is from a series of things that have occurred. Number one, new investments in homeland security that took place after 9/11. Number two, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are going to have price tags north of $1 trillion. Tax cuts that took place in the early part of the 21st century, prescription drug benefit initiatives, Hurricane Katrina, and I could continue to go on and on about all of the things that brought us from in the year 2000 with a budgetary surplus to by the time we got to 2010 with record deficits. I had the opportunity in the spring and summer of last year to work with a wonderful group of people on a bipartisan commission, a private initiative led by, on one hand, Senator Pete Domenici, a Republican former budget chairman from New Mexico, and Alice Rivlin, a Democrat who led the Congressional Budget Office in its earliest of years, to put together a plan to try to confront the nation's fiscal woes. We learned one simple thing from that plan, and that is you will never, ever balance the budget if all you try to do is cut domestic programs. It will not work because they represent less than 15% of the overall budget. And that if a nation is going to be serious, it must place everything on the table. And that means it's got to place on the table sacred cows for some people, like military spending. It's got to have a discussion about the exploding costs of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And you've got to also confront the fact that the tax loopholes inside of the federal budget cost us $1 trillion a year. So I find the discussion that seems to be going on in some ways perplexing, in some ways amusing, because anyone that took out a calculator, right, or a slide rule, or an abacus, or a pencil and a piece of paper and did the math would know that just emasculating domestic programs is not going to fix the nation's fiscal woes. It may cause cheers and jeers, depending on where people sit politically. But what it will not do, so we developed a plan in the bipartisan policy effort, the Debt Reduction Task Force, which included an across-the-board spending freeze, where no department, no program would be exempt, that would spread the burden around. I point this out to you in this discussion because I think that the nation must recognize that we have to confront its fiscal challenges while at the same time not taking steps that are going to create job losses in America today. Take a look. The United Kingdom is engaged in an austerity plan. Their austerity plan is actually causing their economy to contract, It's having not the effect that its sort of architects envisioned. So I point these two items out in this plan, along with the idea that investing in small business, training and educating people is also one of the important keys to building the economy of the 21st century. So my second point, one being the jobs plan, is to also talk to you a little bit about the challenges we face when it comes to education and the preparation of our children. And here's what strikes me. What strikes me is how far we've not gone. What strikes me is how far we have fallen behind. If you look at the ranking of the United States of America when it comes to education compared today to 20 years ago, what you will find is that many other nations have leapt ahead. Their reading levels, their math levels, their investments in education have caused them to grow by leaps and bounds while we seem to be stagnated in this country when it comes to education. We have to confront the fact that we cannot fix the challenges that our educational system faces with lip service. We have to confront the challenge that it's not going to be fixed with any rifle shot deal, but it's going to require a long-term commitment, to changing the reality. So you can't fix the problems of high school and middle school and the high school graduation rate without getting serious about providing early childhood education for every child in this nation and take the step to say that our children have to start school at age three. We can't fix the challenges that education faces and the increasing demands in this changing environment unless we recognize that this notion and this idea of having a 9-to-3 school day as the norm is going to work. Our children need to be in school more hours and more days. So we advocate longer school days and longer school years. We can't fix the problem of education if we think charter schools alone are going to fix the problem of education. Can charter schools help? Can they be laboratories of innovation? Can they allow for new things to be tried? Absolutely they can. But what we need to say is our commitment in this nation is for good schools that meet high standards, no matter what you call them, no matter how they are organized, whether they're located in the city, in the suburbs, or in a rural county in Indiana or any other state. So we've got to confront the challenge. We cannot fix the problem of education in this country unless we get serious about the financing disparities that exist from county to county, from school to school, where in some states per pupil expenditures in one area may be four times as much as they are in another area. And we can't fix the problem of education if we don't realize that young people from disadvantaged backgrounds need more, not less, may need additional supports, additional interventions in order to do this. And we can't fix the problem of education by simply raising standards, although raising standards is absolutely critical and important, unless we raise inputs, better trained teachers, better targeted investments, more technology for our schools. So what is the point? The point is that there is no simple, easy out. The punditry sometimes and the conversation that goes on. I hear people say on one hand, all you've got to do is get rid of these teachers' unions and schools will be fixed. And then I go in another room and say, all you've got to do is wake up these parents and get them to do their job, and these schools will get fixed. And then you go in another room and they said, all we've got to do is turn every school to a charter school and these schools will be fixed. And you go in another room and they say, all we've got to do is fix the problem of financing of education. Just put more money in there and all these schools will be fixed. I implore intelligent thinking people to understand that it's going to require a combination of things. It's going to require an approach which is not gripped in ideology to confront the problem of education and the preparation of our young people for the economy of tomorrow. We're at a point in American history where the new economy, the economy of advanced manufacturing, the economy of bioscience and life sciences, the economy that places technology and technological aptitude at the center of most jobs, is an economy that will demand and require a better educated workforce. And a better educated workforce that is not just some better educated people, but an educated workforce all the way across the board. We're at a crossroads. We're at a crossroads where the debate and the discussion that the nation must have at this time is what will be our priority. And the recognition that in a time of great challenge, you can't do every single thing. What should be our priority? And I think our priority has to be those things that lead to good jobs, that pay good wages, and create economic sustainability in the future. So if it leads to that, then we should do it. If it leads to that, we should invest in it. If it leads to that, we should champion it. We're in a new world. We're in a world of a rising China, a rising India, a rising Brazil. We're in a new world where new nations that we never even thought of as anywhere competing with our great economy and our great nation are rising quickly and rising fast. It's a new reality that we, as a generation of business, civic, political, educational leaders, must confront. And it's a new reality for which there are no easy and simple solutions. But it is a reality where history will teach us there has never been a nation on earth that went wrong by focusing too much on education. Never been a nation on earth. There have been nations on earth that may have focused too much on its military. There have been nations on earth that may have focused more on government largesse and programs. But there's never been a nation on earth. There's never been a nation in humankind that went wrong because it invested too much in the skills level of its children, of its adults, and its people, and their ability to command, their ability to innovate, their ability to build. Here in Indianapolis, at the Indianapolis Urban League, on the ground, we are working with young people in junior high and high school through an initiative called Project Ready. It has a very, very simple metric or measure. We're trying to make sure that every child that participates in this program graduates from high school on time. It is very simple. It's after-school academic support, so out-of-time academic supports. It's designed to give everyone an individualized plan or course of action. We're looking at focusing more on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics preparation. We're trying to do our part. But as successful as a program like that may be, as successful as it is, supported primarily by private dollars, for every one child we serve, there's probably 10 on a waiting list, 10 that certainly can be served. We can never go wrong as a nation by investing in our children and investing in our future. So jobs and what leads to jobs should be this nation's priority. And I know here in Indianapolis, with the commitments that you are making, with the focus on ed reform, with a focus on building a new economy, an economy of the 21st century. This city and this region can indeed lead the way and perhaps show and teach other communities. I'm here to listen and indeed to learn and to find out more about what you are doing here in this city and here in this state as we continue with this job tour. But I believe that we must recognize that we are now at this incredible crossroads in American history. We're at a crossroads of time, a crossroads of events, and a crossroad of generations. And our task, our responsibility, if you will, our challenge, if you will, is how we set the stage for the 21st century economy. The nation has faced these sorts of challenges many, many times. And we must do it in a way that recognizes that 21st century America is indeed going to be different from a demographic standpoint. It's going to be a nation that will no longer have a majority ethnic group. We must build an economy which creates inclusiveness for everyone that wants to get ahead, that creates options and creates opportunities. So I want to thank you for listening to me today. I recommend our 12-point jobs plan for you to take a look at and to have spirited debate. I encourage us to accept this challenge that if we are going to build a 21st century economy, everything we must do, we must ask the question, does it lead to jobs? Does it lead to jobs that pay good wages? Does it lead to an economy that will provide jobs for all? Challenge your elected officials. Challenge yourselves. Let's challenge our business and civic organizations to ask themselves that question before we make any moves. And let's remember, it's about priorities. And I say, prioritize our children, prioritize education, and our next generation will be one of great abundance. Thank you very much. I have something for you. Thank you for the glass of water. But this is a very, very special item. It's a tie that you'll enjoy wearing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we have questions?
Questions.
Yes, certainly. Questions?
I've got, okay. I get to
you get to
read them, and I'm going to start with one that personalizes exactly the argument about you were making about education. As we discussed, you're a parent of three children. One's not a child anymore. Mm-hmm. But as you think about education and the role of education, and you look at an audience, many of whom are parents, what would you tell them first they should do to advance the agenda, the policy agenda, or the specific personal agenda related to education and improving its success?
Obviously, if you're a parent, your first responsibility is your own. Your own children, your own grandchildren, those children that are in any way in your life, to motivate them and to certainly encourage them. And I think that one of the things that can be very enlightening for all of us in the room who are adults, we've got some great young people here who are soon to be young adults, on their way to being young adults, is to be introspective and ask yourself, what played a role in your own success? Was it parents? Was it coaches and teachers and counselors? What role did your education play? Ask yourself, would you be where you are but for your education, but for where you are? Because I think the idea is to self-enlightenment, for us to enlighten ourselves about how we got to where we are and what played a role in our own success. It inspires me to want to work and fight so that every child would have just some of, or in some cases, better than what I had. It's very personal, and I think that that's sort of a gut check that we all need to make on ourselves. When we say, sometimes we can trend in the direction of saying, well, you know, I raised my kids, I'm grown, that's not an issue for me anymore. I really don't want to, I don't think it's important. I've got to think more about myself. But also to think long term about what legacy we as a generation want to leave for the nation. That's really important because every generation leaves a legacy. The 20th century generations left a wide range of legacies. There was a technological revolution in the 20th century. There were incredible wars fought in the 20th century. There was a battle for both racial and gender equality in the 20th century. At the end of the 20th century, we had a stronger, more economically prosperous, better nation than we had at the early part of the 20th century. So we should ask ourselves what that legacy should be.
Thank you. Here's a question about the work that you do at the Urban League, and it's asking, how is the Urban League working with the challenge of the Tea Party national agenda of small government and reduced support for disadvantaged individuals?
You know, the Tea Party to me was a fascinating movement because in a short period of time, they really crystallized and caught public attention. In many respects, the Tea Party to 2010 were what President Obama was to 2008. It became a movement that fascinated the media, that generated a lot of attention and generated a great deal of energy, albeit with a different constituency than what President Obama did, obviously, in 2008. I addressed, and I'll address again, I think it is not right for the nation to seek to lessen the size of government totally on the backs of programs that serve disadvantaged and vulnerable people. I think that it's just not the right thing to do. However, I'm not one who will say that the programs or the initiatives that I may hold dear should be off limits or in a protected zone when it comes to the nation's fiscal challenges. But I believe that other sacred cows, be they tax expenditures and tax loopholes, be they the military, if we're going to assault waste, fraud, and useless programs, then everything has to be on the table. We have to consider everything. That's the only way to have a fair conversation. Pick up the microscope, pick up the magnifying glass, and put it on every component of the government, not just on the backs of the most vulnerable citizens or on a handful of domestic programs. And I feel that way, and I think that that is something that everyone should be able to embrace. If we're going to talk about shared pain, if we're going to talk about shared suffering, shared contributions to the future of the nation, then it has to be shared, and we can't, because of our politics, wall things off and say, don't touch this, don't touch that, this can never be examined or looked at. And I feel very strongly, and I hope you can embrace, no matter what your political philosophy is, embrace that point of view and challenge our elected officials to say, yeah, we need to look at everything. I was amazed when I served on the debt reduction task force that the tax expenditures, talk about politics and earmarks, you go look at the tax code. I mean, there are provisions in the tax code that benefit single companies, that benefit single industries, that benefit single companies and single industries for a single day of the year. There are so many things out there that would shock the conscience, but, you know, you got to be a pretty smart tax lawyer to even read it and understand it. Talk about fuzzy language. It's fuzzy language by design.
A good follow-up question to that is, given the economic woes that you've described, how would the Urban Jobs Act and homesteading program be funded?
Well, the urban homesteading program, we think that there are things in this plan that can be funded through redirection of existing funds. For example, in the urban homesteading area, you're really talking about creating an opportunity. Mayor Bing of Detroit just tried something like that. He took foreclosed property that the city of Detroit owns and says, I'm going to make it available to Detroit City police officers for $1,000. All they've got to do is agree to live in it and fix it up. You can't speculate in it. You can't buy it and hold it. You've got to buy it, fix it up, and live in it for a certain period of time. So to a great extent, when I think of an urban homesteading program, there are probably 1 million properties that are owned by banks and other intermediary organizations that have been foreclosed on. And if we're simply going to wait around for the real estate market to come back to put this property back in commerce, we may be waiting around for a long, long time. So my thinking is, why not stimulate the economy? You could limit it to university professors. You could limit it to public employees. You could limit it to police officers and firefighters. You could take the program and tailor it for a community to try to create energy around home ownership. So some of these things are not just about money, although some of them are. Some of them are about being much more intelligent about what we're doing with the assets we already have. There was a report recently about the nation's investments in job training. Well, I don't think that the nation should cut its investments in job training, but I do believe they need to be redirected to programs that work. I do believe they need to be focused on those initiatives that work, and I've got a long list of them. They just happen to be run by the National Urban League.
again, a related question. Our colleagues in this audience are thinking through how to make these kind of programs happen. Thinking of green energy, I've wondered what would be wrong with a national gasoline tax to encourage the market to choose the alternative versus the government subsidizing any specific one.
So what's the matter with it?
Could we have add to the national gas tax to stimulate a market?
Well, I'm not prepared to endorse that now. Well, here's the reality. The reality is we are in an environment, right, where people do not want to dig in their pockets to pay more taxes for anything, right? There's a reality. If you disagree, please stand up. Please stand up. Let me find one person who's going to fess up and stand up. I don't see one person. That's a hard check on the reality. But the idea, lessening demand for fossil fuels is, I think, the thinking behind increasing the gas tax. And there's discussions that are always ongoing about increasing the gas tax to put more investments in high-speed rail, to put more investments in roads, bridges, and highways, to put more investment in green transportation projects. And this may not necessarily absolutely be the time to do those sorts of investments, but I do think that there's something about those sorts of public policy interventions that should never be off the table. But the reality is that today people are not in the mood to invest more. But that's not that if there's a, quote, plan to fix the nation's fiscal woes and people can see their way through this recession, that people are not going to feel some confidence in investing more. But I think right now there simply isn't that confidence, and I think not even that confidence in places that traditionally have supported ideas like that. My main point about the green economy is this. If we are serious about the green economy, we better get our incentives aligned, or we're basically, with our consumer power, going to be creating demand for things that are produced abroad, for workers abroad, for jobs abroad. And I just feel that this nation should think about nascent industries that we have a chance to build, and creating incentives and structures that allow them to build themselves up. Because we're in an economic situation where, overseas, the governments of countries like China and India do not have a problem with subsidizing nascent industries with cash, with low-interest investments. We're not on a level playing field here. And so we've got to utilize. I'm for fair trade, right? Trade that's fair, level. We can get access to your markets, you can have access to our markets, but something becomes wrong when everybody can get access to what? Our markets, and we can, our businesses and our exports can't get access to their markets. And these are jobs issues that traditionally we don't talk about openly enough. To say we want to build, you've got here in Indianapolis, this incredible sort of life and health sciences foundation that you're building. And you've already got, it's a tremendous job creator. You've got a lot of businesses. There's some strategies underway. I think the idea ought to be to take that and make it the biggest and the best. Align the education to that. Align university curriculums to it. Try to align all the incentives that you're going to do, whether they be regulatory, tax-oriented, around building those types of jobs, and then train people for them. Tell the young people, we're building life sciences. We're building health sciences. So you know what that means? You need to be good in algebra. You need to be good in geometry. You need to take that biology, chemistry, and physics course. And we're going to make sure you have the help you need to do well in it. And that's how you build a coherent, economic strategy. And you've got the base for it right here in Indianapolis. I'm impressed with it, but I'm saying don't be afraid to take it to the next level.
I have to say, let's give him thanks on that note.
You've been listening to Mark Morial, President and CEO of the National Urban League. The organization focuses on education and job training initiatives for blacks and operates a fund that has contributed tens of millions of dollars to minority businesses through debt and equity investments. Dennis Bland is the CEO and President of the Center for Leadership Development, which works with young people to help prepare them to become economic contributors to Indiana.
Brain power translates into dollars. People compensate you for what you know that they don't know. And so we obviously live in an environment and an economy where we want educated people, because educated people have the capacity to get us what we need or get us what we desire. And so we're willing to compensate people for that information or that knowledge. Obviously, then people live in your community, they're being educated. They then transfer that education for some form of compensation. Then you have an economy that's thriving. You have a market that has more people employed, more people spending money. And so that is what obviously drives an economy. And so CLD is helping young people get that education so that they have that powerful commodity that they can exchange for compensation or other benefits. And so that is what's helping our economy. And we just need more young people on that cycle, obviously. CLD's primary role is really at ground zero, trying to give our responsibilities to give young people an education on an education. So I think this becomes one of our community's most vital roles in helping young people understand the value of an education. Oftentimes we say, get an education, but many of our young people have rarely been schooled, or many of our young people have not been schooled on why an education is so important, the benefits of an education, the consequences of not getting an education. There needs to be an education on an education, and CLD is doing that. And with that, within that education on an education, the young people then are inspired to take their courses more seriously, but then they are also being taught what we call college literacy. And so now young people who at first may not have been interested in an education, all of a sudden there is a higher interest in it, and oftentimes even a thirst for it. And then you have individuals who had an interest, but they didn't have the knowledge. The college literacy part comes in and says, now that you see how important an education is, and now that you're beginning to understand how important a college education is, let's begin to build literacy for you on how you access dollars that would help you finance your post-secondary education experience. We actually have about 16 different programs and experiences that teach young people about education readiness and life skills. So you may come into a class and you'll see us teaching young people. Oftentimes, so many of the skill sets that are taken for granted, we're teaching young people how to study. We teach them how to take notes. We teach them how to prepare for tests. We teach them how to set up study environments conducive to learning. This is the type of environment that helps you get good grades. This is the type of study environment that will not contribute to you getting good grades. It will not advance your learning. No distractions, no clutter, and no TV. We actually have exercises around these types of teachings, as well as then teaching young people how long to study. For example, when you come to the Center for Leadership Development, the young people know that for all CLD participants, the minimum study time per evening is 2 hours, not 15 minutes, not 30 minutes, not an hour and a half. Minimum study time is 2 hours per evening, 2 hours time on task. Well, time on task, what does that mean? Well, at CLD, these young people learn what time on task means. That if you say you're going to study 2 hours and you have spent 15 minutes of your 2 hours on the phone, then you have an additional 15 minutes to go.
I see.
The amount of time that you actually spend studying a subject matter, trying to become proficient in the subject matter, that's time on task. Whereas the problem with so many young people is that they would sit down for an hour, and yet they are giving themselves credit for 1 hour of studying, whereas the reality is oftentimes dependent upon the number of text messages they're sending, dependent upon how much time they were watching TV, they've essentially wasted 1 hour. Or they have spent 1 hour doing what they wanted to do, but they did not spend 1 hour developing some proficiency in algebra because that time was not spent on the task for which they sat down to achieve. And so, again, it's easy for people who understand education to understand that it just makes sense. And yet for a number of young people who've never had that education, they would sit back, and if no one has ever critiqued that, they would sit back and say, I can't understand why I'm not mastering this subject. Well, number one, you're not studying at all. Number two, once you start studying, you're not studying long enough to be able to master that subject.
That's Dennis Bland, President and CEO of the Center for Leadership Development. Coming up next time on the Economic Club of Indiana, 33-year news veteran Gwen Ifill, managing editor and senior correspondent for PBS and host of Washington Week in Review. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sharon Allseth.
ProLiance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.